Well, welcome everyone. I can see from the number of people here that Peter Wilson really doesn't need a lot of introduction. Some of you will remember him from when he was a fellow of New Common. Then he, to our sorrow, he went back to his native Sydney. What you may not know is that he and Eric Chapeau are working on a huge three-volume project that will not only totally supersede Picard Cambridge, Sir Arthur, which is high time, because Sir Arthur's books were never really that good in the first place. and their volumes will not only totally re-examine all of the evidence, but will really create an entirely new cultural history of Greek theatre by giving it a great deal more social, political, economic, and archaeological context. And what I will tell you, because Peter might not, is that Volume 1 has already been delivered to Cambridge University Press. So this really is happening. And I'm hoping that Peter's going to give us this afternoon a glimpse of some of the things that are going to be in his project with Eric. Please. So, as I say, it's a great pleasure to welcome Peter Wilson here to give us the talk this afternoon. Peter.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Oliver, for that very, very kind introduction. It's really wonderful for me to be back here and back, in the archive of which I've been an ardent supporter from afar since its inception, but this is the first time I've ever actually been here to give a talk in connection with it, so that's a really great pleasure, and thank you very much for the invitation. Well, as Eric said, as Oliver said, let me work out where I am, for around about a decade, if not more, Eric Chapeau and I have been working on a fundamental review of the evidence for the social and economic history of the theatre from round about 500 to 300. Some people, like Oliver, describe our project as an attempt to rewrite Picard Cambridge, and it is a little bit in that direction. But Picard Cambridge, as Oliver indicated, really had very little interest in social and economic issues or in relation to drama at all. It's actually volume 2 of our social and economic history, which is now complete, but it is the first one to be complete, confusingly. And this deals with the expansion of theatre beyond Attica, through Attica and beyond, into the wider Greek world for the first 200 years. So this afternoon, I want to ask what role, if any, politics played in this incredible spread of theatre. And I'd ask you to keep two things in mind. One is what Oliver's already mentioned, that a good half of the research behind this paper should be credited to Eric. And secondly, that there's not really a lot of time for me to go into a lot of detail of the material on which I'm basing the conclusion. So I'll be summarizing and giving a few examples to illustrate what I think are some of the big trends. Well, a short history of the background of the question might begin with the 1990 volume Nothing to Do with Dionysus, Athenian Drama in its Social Context. In 1990, it was radically new, at least in Anglophone scholarship, in that it focused on the question of theatre's politics in the abstract. But it was also the last major contribution to scholarship that assumed with assurance that only Athens mattered. The book described the context and content of tragedy and comedy as expressions of Athenian democracy's values and aspirations. But the claim provoked challenges fairly quickly. Just how exclusively Athenian or democratic were the theatre and its genres? The challenge to Athenian and the challenge to democratic followed different paths. One explored theatre outside Athens, to quote the title of Kate Bosch's book of 2012. The other questioned whether theatre, and especially tragedy, could be said to be democratic or even political at all. Some people, like Jasper Griffin, emphasised the timeless, universal, aesthetic and philosophical quality of Greek tragic poetry. Others, like Peter Rhodes, without abandoning a historicist agenda, looked for a deep structuring context, not in any specific city or constitution, but in the historical development of the polis itself. The question becomes particularly urgent when one combines the two paths. If it's true that theatre was not just Athenian, does that mean that it also cannot be characterised as democratic? Many states with theatres were autocracies, and some were oligarchies. So how can we talk of theatre as being democratic or Athenian at all? Well, Eric and I have taken a fairly empirical approach to this question. And by looking at the data, we tried to decide if the various sources of evidence allowed us to match the reception of theatre with constitutional regimes in Greece. So it turns into a question of reception, I hope appropriately for the archive, effectively trying to decide how the ancients thought on the basis of what they were doing. Some insight can be gained from the choices communities made in the 5th and 4th century as the new medium spread throughout the Greek world. Some states eagerly adopted theatre, others avoided it. Communities that did receive it similarly chose to accept or to avoid specific theatrical genres and specific festival practices. Well, it's well known that contemporary authors say very little about the politics of theatre. Aristotle is largely silent. There is notoriously no polis in Aristotle's Poetics. Athens is mentioned only three times and democracy once, all in relation to the disputed history of comedy. Less attention has been paid to Plato, who definitely sees drama as part of democratic culture. But in the Republic, this famous passage, he claims that tragedy, at least, belongs more to autocratic culture. Tragic poets drag or draw constitutions towards tyrannies and democracies. The word order is deliberate. He goes on to say that tragic poets are honoured especially by the tyrants, and secondly, by democracy. But Plato is, of course, a biased witness, and his perceptions don't often reflect general attitudes. But was he right? A close examination of over 120 sites has yielded credible evidence of some form of theatre culture before 300 BC. We looked for evidence of a building that ancients or moderns could credibly identify as a theatre, evidence of performances of the theatre genres of drama or circular choruses, sometimes called dithyrambic choruses, or some other strong index of theatrical culture, such as the prolific comic vase production of Taras, which, along with statements from Plato, Aristoxenus, and others, makes it more than probable that Taras had theatre, at least in the 4th century. Of the cities examined, something over half, around 70, also offered evidence of their political configuration at the date in which they received theatre. In this list, reasonable uncertainty, if you can work out what that means, is marked with question marks. A question mark before the name of the city means doubt about the existence of theatre or theatrical activity in that city. A question mark after the name means doubt about its political constitution. Brackets means that the city is double listed. That's to say it was in one of two categories of constitution. Well, Plato may have been right in suggesting that autocracies were the most enthusiastic recipients of theatre culture, but he was wrong if he meant to imply simple numerical superiority. Our figures show twice as many democracies receiving theatre as autocracies. But Plato is most vindicated in his implication that theatre did not appeal to oligarchs. Only four certain, and another five possible, oligarchic cities had any kind of theatre, compared with about 26 to 45 democracies or 16 to 21 autocratically governed states. And this doesn't simply reflect the difference in the numerical ratios of different regimes. Hansen and Nielsen's inventory calculates that a bit over 32% of classifiable 4th century regimes were oligarchic, against about 41% democratic. And if we assume those figures apply also for the 5th century, although we might imagine that there are a few more democracies in the 5th than the 4th, we can apply the statistics to get a comparison. So you can see that democracy is still grabbing more of the theatrical pie on the right than it deserves according to its prevalence, which is shown on the left. And this is only slightly less true of autocracies. And the percentages don't change, at least not significantly, if we eliminate those cases in which we assigned question marks. The glutton's share of the pie still belongs to democracy. So only around 6 to 12% of 5th and 4th century cities that had some sort of theatre culture were oligarchies at the time it was introduced, whereas the corresponding figure for democracies is close to 64. We'll see, moreover, that oligarchic theatre culture is not only sparse, but different and odd in other ways. But first, let's examine some of the patterns in the spread of theatre in democracies. So Athens created one of the primary channels through which theatre spread. In the 5th century, the Athenian Empire, and in the 4th, its Aegean hegemony in the form of the Second Athenian Confederacy. The most direct transfer was through the transplantation of bits of Athens itself. Direct imitation of Athens was normal for Athenian clerarchies and colonies. As Robert Parker put it some time ago, the clerarchies of the 4th century were little replicas of Athens, with their own councils and assemblies, and it's scarcely surprising to find such a basic amenity of Attic life as a tragic festival of Dionysus soon attested. The best examples are Salamis, Lemnos, and Samos. Salamis was never incorporated into the Attic deme system, even though it's just off the coast. The island was settled by Athenians in the late 6th century and was probably a clerarchy from that time. The Athenians appointed an archon for Salamis, and to judge by the Athpol, his biggest job was to run the Dionysia. Monuments indicate that Salamis had a choregic system, tragedy, and circular choruses by the end of the 5th century. Lemnos came under Athenian control around 500. The Athenians expelled the non-native population and planted colonists to make the island entirely theirs. Exploration of the early Hellenistic theatre at Hephaestia has recently revealed an earlier 5th century phase. This 5th century theatre was superimposed on a native Lemnian sanctuary to a goddess whom the Athenian settlers worshipped as a form of Cybele or Demeter and associated with Dionysus, a connection that proved sympathetic to the incorporation of the Lemnian Dionysus within Attic and Eleusinian cult that we find in Euripides' Hypsipyle. From around 350, inscriptions attest to Dionysia, dramatic contests, a choregic system, and the announcement of public honours in the theatre, but it's very likely that these were part of Lemnian life already in the 5th century. Samos spent much of the 5th century as a more or less autonomous ally of Athens, and first received an Athenian clerarchy after its revolt in 440, and then a second one, which involved the expulsion of the local population around 365. The oldest honorific decree from Samos, which is this, dated to around 350, is by the Athenian clerics themselves. It provides, as you can see, for the announcement of honors at the tragic contest of the local Dionysia. Well, several other states owe their theatre culture to Athenians being sent abroad in this way. The speaker of Antiphon 5 claims that his father served as choregos in Mytilene after the Lesbian revolt in 428, when Athens planted clerics there. Athenian clerics probably also contributed to the development of theatre in Eritrea, Naxos, and Andros. And the phenomenon may not be limited to the Aegean. Thurii in South Italy was in large part an Athenian foundation in the time of Pericles, and many believe that it was a major transfer point of Athenian culture, including theatre, to the wider region. More common in the Aegean is the reception of theatre by democratic subjects, states that are subject to Athens. To reinforce their military and economic interests, Athens attempted to bind her Delian League allies with political and cultural ties. Two policies had important implications for the history of theatre. One was Athens' general support for the democratic factions in allied cities. This reinforced Athens' imperial influence not only through the creation of common political values, but also through fear of political instability and the oligarchic reprisals that might follow a withdrawal of Athenian support. The other was a more direct involvement of allies within what Peter Rhodes called the Imperial Festival, Athens' own city Dionysia. It was to the Athenian Dionysia that allies brought their tribute each year, probably beginning immediately after the transference of the treasury from Delos to Athens in 453. Particularly revealing of the care Athens took to involve subjects directly in the festival is the very well-known Athenian decree of 372 that required the city of Paros to bring a cow and a phallus to the Dionysia, since they are in fact colonists of the people of Athens. This requirement is said to be kata ta patria, as though couldn't be over-egging it all the more, since it's entirely unlikely to be true. And we know that colonists were indeed to bring a phallus and to the Dionysia from another very well-known decree of 440, founding the colony of Brea. But the only basis for the assertion that Paros was a colony of Athens was Athens' own mythic claim to be the mother of all the Ionians. The example of Paros shows very strongly, or suggests at least strongly, that all Ionian cities were subject to the same requirements. The phallos and the cow would probably require a group, a chorus probably, to accompany them in the Dionysian procession. So the delegations that went from subject states to Athens would have been reasonably large, adding chorus members to the officials who went to discuss military and political matters with Athens. Familiarity with the Athenian Dionysia can therefore be assumed throughout the empire from at least the middle of the 5th century. It would be a mistake, though, to regard this invitation to the Dionysia as simply a form of imperial coercion. The tribute was probably seen that way from time to time, but the Dionysia made that burden sweeter. In fact, it seems that the allies, to an extent, embraced the Dionysia as a symbol of the empire's cultural power, because cities of the empire are the largest and most coherent group in the classical spread of theatre. Athenian subjects known to have theatre more than triple the number of cities that get drama through a direct connection with Athens. In general, then, the Aegean region presents several consistent features that can be ascribed to imitation of the Athenian model. The first is that all these cities were members of Athens' Aegean Empire. The second is that all of them, except Chios, were, so far as we can tell, certainly or probably democracies at the time they received theatre. Chios is a special case that we'll come back to in a minute. Third is that all the theatrical festivals held in these cities, so far as we can tell, are initially at least Dionysia, which is definitely not the case in many other regions. And fourth, where the evidence exists, all of them resemble the Athenian Dionysia in a number of ways, in the competitive format, in the kinds of genres that are being performed. Tragedy is almost universally attested, but comedy, satyr play, and men's and boys' lyric choruses appear throughout the region. Also, similar is their public funding through a choregic system and in imitation of other festival practices. A striking example comes not from an Ionian, but from the Dorian city of Rhodes, founded by the Synoicism of 4087 of Ioulousos, Chimeros, and Lindos. Rhodes may have been a Spartan-dominated oligarchy at its foundation, but before 395, it revolted against Sparta and became a democracy. Rhodes's founding cities had been members of the Delian League, and in 378, Rhodes became a founding member of the Second Athenian Confederacy. Probably from the very beginning of its democracy, and certainly by the 380s, Rhodes had its own Dionysia with a program comparable to that of Athens. Our information for this comes unexpectedly from Rome. 20 fragments of inscriptions recording theatre productions were mostly recovered from medieval buildings or Renaissance collections, but three of them were excavated in modern times, all from the district of Rome where the theatres of Pompey, Balbus, and Marcellus were located. In this region, the temple of Hercules Musarum formed the headquarters of the Roman artists of Dionysus, or Artifices Scynici. And since other fragments of the same date and style actually mention the artists, it's believed that this huge inscription decorated the walls of their office. Most of the fragments of these so-called Roman fasti deal with the Athenian Dionysia and the Athenian Lanaia. Less well studied are 8 fragments that treat the Dionysia at Rhodes. All of them are found in the pavement of the church at San Paolo, and 7 of them are now lost, except for a transcription by Filippo Buonarroti over there, great-grandnephew of Michelangelo. Internal evidence of the inscription shows that it's a first-century inscription copying a much earlier Hellenistic source. So this combination of fragments shows that by the 380s, Rhodes had something resembling the Athenian Dionysia in its content and scale. The San Paolo fragments detail the careers of star tragic actors. They're listed, the actors, in chronological order of their first victory at any of the 3 festivals, the 2 Athenian festivals and the Rhodian Dionysia. After each actor's name, follow all of his first place finishes, then his second place finishes, then thirds, with prizes in each category in chronological order. In addition to prizes and festivals, the inscription names the plays with which the actor competed and the authors of those plays. Sorry, that's not that easy to read, but there it is. Because of uncertainty regarding the length of the lines of these inscriptions, which can't really be reconstructed, it's really hard to know which part belongs to which festival. But Rhodes is explicitly mentioned in 3 places. In two of those places, the assignment of an actor to a tribe, that Nemethes over there, the fool after Cameris, is explicitly mentioned. Which shows that each set of tragedies was publicly funded by the tribes of the new Rhodian state, a bit like the way lyric choruses were funded in Athens. So there were, as a result, three entries in the tragic competition, each of them assigned to one of the founding tribes named for the founding cities, Ialousos, Camiros, and Lindos. As no other source we know of records more than a single prize for acting, either in Athens or anywhere else, Rhodes has a very special importance. Because of its tribal funding model, and because the actors here performed in the role of didaskaloi, producers, all three of the actors were ranked. Rhodian records thus offer detailed information about early actors that could be found apparently nowhere else. Athenian records name only the winning actor. Rhodian records ranked the actors as first, second, and third, and thereby gave later antiquity a special window onto the careers of the famous classical actors, not only showing who won, but who beat whom with what. This explains why these records were of special interest to the Roman Actors Guild. Well, the actors named on the inscription are known from other sources, Mnesithius, Thrasybulus, Eupolemus, and Cleandrus, possibly Aristodemus and Philotades. The poets whose plays they directed were international stars of their day, but they included classics as well as contemporary tragedians. Sophocles is named at least once, and judging from the titles, it's the elder Sophocles, possibly also Aristarchus. Note too that it seems that two satyr plays are named, suggesting that at a time when Athens, the genre was obsolescent, and only performed in isolation as a kind of warm-up to and outside the competition, Rhodes was still producing traditional tetralogies. Other inscriptions from Rhodes, 4th century inscriptions, show that the tribes appointed choregoi to sponsor boys' choruses, and later ones show them supporting men's choruses and comedy. The fragments of the Roman Fasti give no evidence of comedy in early 4th century Rhodes, but the fact that Anaxandrides and Antiphanes, two of the most productive comic poets of the first half of the 4th century, were Rhodians, suggests that comedy was also a likely feature of the original Rhodian Dionysia. And as you can see, these inscriptions are really extremely fragmentary in any case. In other words, it looks as if from the creation of the democracy in 395, Rhodes had a full Dionysia with everything and more than contemporary Athens offered, including competitions of men's and boys' choruses, tragic tetralogies with satyr play, comedy, a competition for actors with three prizes, a system of choregic funding, a practice of setting up victory monuments, and accurate public archives that recorded competitors and winners. In fact, the presence of tetralogies with satyr plays suggests, if anything, that the Rhodians adopted and preserved a classic 5th century format after Athens itself had abandoned them. This impression is strongly reinforced by information from Diodorus. He tells us that in 305, when under threat from Demetrius, the Rhodians passed decrees liberating slaves, giving public burial for the war dead, and granting a panoply to their sons in the theatre at the Dionysia when they came of age. These provisions are all, as I'm sure you know, known from Athens, but the last is of special interest because it directly copies a pre-performance ritual of the Athenian theatre from much earlier in the century. Rhodian theatre culture thus follows the classic Athenian model to the letter, and arguably does so not out of any excess love of Athens, but to adopt Athens' paradigmatically democratic theatre culture. Well, Rhodes is close to a third variety of reception. There were democracies with no particular connection to Athens that embraced theatre, purely as an expression, I would say, of democratic culture. Take, for example, the cities of Arcadia, that had absolutely no part in Athens' Aegean Empire. Spartan hegemony sat heavily over Arcadia until the Battle of Leuctra in 371. At that point, the Arcadians threw off their Spartan-backed oligarchies and became democracies. In addition, they formed the Arcadian League with a view to resisting a Spartan resurgence and founded Megalopolis to serve as their capital. A monumental theatre stood at the very heart of that city's redesign. The precise date of the completion of the Megalopolis Theatre in stone is disputed, but we have compelling evidence for a theatre from the 360s, from reused blocks that have blocks from the original stage building found in a later 4th century Skene. And these blocks, as you can see from the picture there, have cuttings in them designed for receiving timbers, which indicates that there was a phase of the theatre before that. This was the largest theatre in Greece, even in Pausanias' day, and a conspicuous emblem of new cultural aspirations. The 5th century theatre of Mantinea was rebuilt in stone at this very time, and new theatres were built in Tegea and Orchomenus. It's immediately after the liberation from Spartan hegemony that we first hear of a theatre in Phigalia, where the oligarchic faction, before withdrawing to the safety of Sparta, took bloody revenge on the new democracy by swooping down on their fellow citizens as they sat in the theatre watching a performance. Arcadia, moreover, seems to have adopted a uniform theatre culture. All of these cities had Dionysia with publicly funded contests, but on a slightly different model from Athens. They were run by an agonathete, and there was a practice of dedicating stone seats in the theatre at the end of their termly year of office. We don't have evidence of drama, but the Arcadian Polybius attests the popularity in what he regarded as antiquity of men's and boys' circular choruses, specifically by composers associated with the first great wave of popular so-called theatre music, Philoxenus and the famously laconophobic Timotheus. Well, let's now think about oligarchy. I mentioned briefly at the beginning that these were surprisingly few. In fact, Calydon, Chaeronea, and Thespiae are more likely to have been democracies when their theatres were built, and Abydos was possibly an autocracy. So our focus needs to be on Chios, Corinth, Megara, and Sparta. Unlike theatre in democratic states, oligarchic theatre is idiosyncratic, and it's got a few odd characteristics, however, shared among the various states. The first is that for a very small group, there are a large number of 5th century, especially early 5th century, starting dates. The second is that most had choral performances in their theatres, but no drama of any sort. Megara is a major exception because it had comedy, but it was a comedy independent of the Athenian type and probably older. Dick Green posits a regional form of comedy for Corinth as well on the basis of the iconographic material. Perhaps the one thing oligarchies do have in common is their complete avoidance of tragedy. We have no evidence that any oligarchic state ever initiated a tragic contest. In fact, the only evidence for tragic performance in an oligarchic state comes from Athens in 411, 4043, and 3217. The theatres or festivals for theatres were for the gods other than Dionysus. The exceptions are Megara and Chios. So in general, the few oligarchic states that had theatre remained independent of the main trends and independent in their own ways. Many developed before one could even speak of an Athenian paradigm. All of them seem to have remained aloof from international trends until well into the Hellenistic period. By the middle of the 5th century, Megara produced a form of drama that other Greeks identified as kormodia, although modern scholars tend to dismiss it as possenspiel, farce, and the like. Aristotle notes that both the Megarians of the mainland and those in Sicily claim to have invented comedy. This probably indicates shared origins in a period of cultural exchange between mother city and colony that necessarily predates the destruction of Megara Hyblaea by Gelon in 483. The mainland Megarians of Aristotle's day, though firmly oligarchic, substantiated their claim to the invention of comedy by pointing out that they had had a democracy earlier than Athens. By doing so, they were acceding to a belief that the connection between comedy and democracy was natural, or at least something that you had to claim. There is, nevertheless, no evidence that the kind of political comedy developed by Cratinus, Aristophanes, and Eupolis ever featured in Megara. Classical Sparta had more than one building that could be called a theatron. One is attested by Herodotus for 486, as the place where during the Gymnopaedia Demaratus received the public insult that led to his self-exile in Persia. This might well have been a 6th or early 5th century construction known famously as the Round Building in the Spartan Agora that, despite its name, may only have been semicircular. Corunnu and others identify it as the so-called Choros, where Pausanias records that the Gymnopaedia took place. Greco has argued more recently that it is the Skias, where Pausanias saw the lyre of Timotheus with its cut strings on display, presumably because it was the place where he had given his musical performances. Whether it was semicircular or round, it's the earliest theatron of either form. Sparta is also the source of the earliest surviving prohedric or honorific seat from any theatre, in this case a theatron in the sanctuary of Athena, Aleia. Our information about activities in Spartan theatres is relatively plentiful. They include local citizen choruses, probably divided by age, tribe and phratry, supported by a choregic system that Aristotle dates back at least to the post-Persian War period, and in which the choregoi served also as the pipers. In addition, there were kithaeronic contests open to international competitors at the Carneia, Gymnopaedia and Hyacinthia, dating back possibly to the 7th century. Theatre music in archaic and classical Sparta was connected to Apollo, possibly Demeter, Artemis and Athena. Significantly, we have no evidence for circular choruses and no evidence for drama until 105 AD. In perhaps one case, we can see Sparta transplanting its theatre culture to another oligarchic state, in much the same way Athens seems to have done to democracies under its dominion. At the time of the Spartan incursion into Boeotia, Agesilaus seems to have taken a role in transferring the rural sanctuary of the Valley of the Muses to Thespiae and in creating a festival of the Muses. It is, however, probably only after 372, when Thespiae came under control of the now democratic Thebes, that the competition included men's and boys' circular choruses and probably kithaeronic and aulos, but no drama again until the end of the 3rd century. In other words, the same pattern we saw in Arcadia can be seen in Boeotia. Despite its long and rich musical and Dionysian traditions, the earliest evidence for theatre in Thebes comes immediately after a democratic coup in 379 that ousted the oligarchs and the Spartan garrison that underwrote their position. Right after the coup, Epaminondas is reported to have obtained a loan from his fellow conspirators to sponsor a men's chorus, and then, about a decade later, finds himself in the theatre on trial for exceeding his constitutional powers. A symmetrical but opposite situation existed in Chios, which I mentioned earlier. As a non-tributary member of the Delian League and then a member of Athens' 4th century naval confederacy, Chios was allowed to retain its oligarchic constitution, which seems to have swung for over a century between moderate and extreme oligarchy, until about 330 when Alexander the Great imposed democracy. Chios successfully resisted the theatre music that otherwise spread like wildfire across the Aegean. And yet Dionysus was hugely important to this island, famous for its wine. Among other things, local legend had it that Dionysus' son, Oinopion, founded Chios. The magnificence of Chios' Dionysia is attested by the early 4th century author Aeneas Tacticus. The same author, however, gives us this very interesting passage, which singles out a very un-Dionysian feature of its otherwise brilliant parades, processions. The Chians' anxiety about the license of the parade might trigger, that it might trigger a revolution, caused them regularly to occupy in advance, with guards and copious troops, the roads opening onto the marketplace. Their icon of Dionysus was even kept in chains. And after being democratized by Alexander, Chios seems only to have added a competition for boys' choruses to its festival. No evidence for drama or even men's choruses at any time in the island's history. The fact that for centuries afterwards public honors were announced at the contest for boys' choruses seems to guarantee the absence of the other more prestigious genres. The absence is all the more astonishing, given that Ion, one of the most acclaimed tragedians of the 5th century, was Chian. We have to conclude that Ion's tragedies were only ever viewed by Chians when they were visiting Athens or other Aegean cities. And it says something of the uneasiness of the relationship of Athens and its ally that Ion, for political reasons, embraced Athenian hegemony to the point of claiming in his own history of the island that Oinopion was not a son of Dionysus, but of Theseus. Ion's Philathenianism was shared by his son, a leader of the democratic faction, whom the oligarchy put to death in 411 on a charge, Thucydides tells us, of being pro-Athenian. Chian democrats, it seems, opened their hearts both to Athens and tragedy as readily as the oligarchs closed theirs, and evidently for the same reasons. This conclusion appears true of oligarchies in general. Well, if democrats and oligarchs were generally agreed that theatre culture and drama in particular are democratic, this view was presumably not shared by autocrats, who, as Plato suggested, were even fonder of tragedy than democracies. Drama's success in autocracies certainly proves that there's nothing essentially democratic about it, even despite the powerful formal links between drama and democratic dialogicity. But at the same time, we need to judge whether autocratic theatre is quite the same as democratic theatre. Is there some sense in which autocracy converts a dialogic form into a monologic one? This is a bigger question than we can start to talk about here, but I'll briefly sketch some major differences in the theatre cultures of late archaic and classical autocracies. The autocracies that received Greek theatre are located on what we might very loosely call the barbarian fringe. Sicily, North Africa, Thessaly, Macedon, Caria, the Black Sea, and Cyprus. From 485 in Syracuse, the tyrants Gelon and Hieron took a keen interest in theatre, as later did Dionysius I. Two 5th century theatres are found in Cyrene, and the excavators now date the earliest stage building of the first to the first half of the 5th century, in the time of the Battiad monarchy. Macedon's engagement with theatre begins with the tyranny of Archelaus around 410. There's evidence for a decree from Magnesia that gave honours to Euripides during his lifetime, so it may be that Thessaly also received theatre about this time, although we only hear of it at Pherae and at Skotoussa in or shortly after 370 in relation to the tyrant Alexander. Theatre and drama first appear in the Pontic region in Heraclea in the time of the Clearchid tyranny as early as the 360s, and by 353 in the Cimmerian Bosporus ruled by the Spartacids. So there's a point to be made about this fringe pattern. It's perhaps easiest to make for Macedon, which for Greeks was actually beyond the barbarian fringe. Theatre in Macedon is a remarkable instance of the adoption of a Greek cultural form by non-Greeks, but Greekness was precisely one of its great attractions for the Macedonian rulers. Theatre made Archelaus and his successors appear Greek to Greek eyes, and this was no small asset in both the economic and the military sphere. A major component of this Greekness, especially in the early period, was Athenianness, given the income and goodwill that Archelaus was able to generate by providing the raw materials to rebuild the Athenian fleet after it was destroyed in Sicily. The situation is similar in the Black Sea. The Spartacids of the half-Scythian Cimmerian Bosporus literally traded on their Athenianness. They personally controlled the very lucrative export in grain and raw materials to Athens, to the point that on one occasion the Athenians directly intervened to save them from a coup, and on another turned a blind eye to their occupation of an Athenian outpost, while granting the Spartacids Athenian citizenship and heaping them with other honours. Another common feature is that, as with oligarchies, theatre festivals in autocratic regimes are normally not Dionysia. In Syracuse, the theatres were associated with sanctuaries of Apollo, Demeter and Cori. This, in fact, appears to be true of most theatres in Sicily, as it is in Cyrene. In Macedon, the first theatre festivals were for Olympian Zeus and the Muses. Only in the Black Sea region are the theatre festivals Dionysia, and so in conformity with the Athenian Aegean Koine. Third point is that, unlike oligarchs, autocrats happily supported all major theatrical genres: tragedy, comedy, circular chorus, satyr play. The evidence confirms Plato's claim that tragedy had a special appeal for autocrats. We do, however, also find comedy flourishing under the Syracusan tyrants, though it may be of a less political and more philosophical kind than its Attic counterpart. Comedy is also attested at the Macedonian court, possibly from the time of Archelaus, but certainly under Philip and Alexander. The life histories of the most famous poets of circular choruses, or dithyram, are bound tight with the tyrants of Macedon and Syracuse. Archelaus kept Melanippides and Timotheus, Dionysius I kept Philoxenus. And it is, notably, Kinesias, the lyric poet, who proposed the honorific decree at Athens for Dionysius I in 393. And that Kinesias is somehow acting as much as a poet of circular chorus as an Athenian citizen is suggested by the fact that this is the first decree we know from Athens to have been actually erected inside the theatre of Dionysus. Alexander sponsored the whole gamut, including satyr play, though the Black Sea autocracies gave direct attestation of only unidentified drama, and kithaerotic performances, the presence of Xenotimus, son of the tragedian Cratinus, in the Bosporan kingdom, serving as a diplomatic courier, suggests tragic performance in the early 4th century. And the Charygic relief indicates comic performance a few decades later. Cyrene, at least at the end of the 4th, or at least during the 4th century, had tragedy, dithyramb, and very probably also comedy. The fourth feature I'd point out is that classical autocrats began the process of personalizing theatre that characterizes later Hellenistic practice. And this personalization affects absolutely every aspect of performance: the occasion, the performers themselves, theatrical space, and the performance. This is an important contrast to the public nature, the more public nature of Athenian theatre. As for occasion, our sources for Syracusan and Macedonian theatre often imply that festivals were arranged at the whim of the autocrat. Literary evidence for theatre performance under Philip and Alexander often takes a form like this: having transacted this business, he went back to Macedonia, he conducted the sacrifices to Zeus Olympius, which had already been established by Archelaus, and he arranged the games at Aigai. Some say that he also did a contest for the Muses. This sort of thing appears even in the accounts of campaigns in distant lands, so there's no question of simply booking into a pre-existing festival. From the very beginning, autocrats made theatre occasional, and the occasions marked milestones in the autocrat's CV: the founding of cities, dynastic weddings, military victories, royal funerals. Even when the festivals are named for gods, they seem to be timed to fit the autocrat's, not the gods, busy schedule. As for the performers and being personalized, Syracusan and Macedonian autocrats bound poets and actors to them with gifts and favors. Many famous poets became their poets in residence. Even Pixodarus, the Hecatomnid tyrant and satrap of Caria, relied on actors as confidants in his secret negotiations with the Macedonians. This kind of intimacy was useful if you wanted to conjure up a theatre festival quickly. Consider again a phrase from Plutarch. Alexander dealt with urgent business and once more turned his attention to theatres and festivals when 3,000 scenic artists arrived from Greece. The scene is Ecbatana, 1,500 kilometres from the eastern limit of the Mediterranean. Actors really did drop everything and run, as did Athenodorus, the famous tragic actor, who stood up the Athenians in 331, knowing that Alexander would pay his fine for non-appearance at their Dionysia and offer him a lot more besides. It's no coincidence that at precisely this period, Athens starts issuing decrees with civic honours for theatrical performers, prominently citing their fidelity to the Athenian people. Theatre space. Well, Jean-Charles Moretti has drawn attention to the monumentality and innovation that marks Sicilian and Macedonian theatre architecture. Gelon of Syracuse may have constructed a monumental theatre that was not only grander than its Athenian counterpart, but possibly served as his tomb. The archaeological evidence is hotly disputed, or at least the bits that Giuseppe Vozza has actually bothered to publish. Autocrats vied with one another and with non-tyrannical states, especially Athens, to assert their geopolitical primacy in what looks like a race to build the largest or most magnificent stone theatre. Moretti, in fact, suggests that Macedon succeeded in producing a horseshoe-shaped stone theatre before the Lycurgan Theatre was finished in Athens, and may also have created the first ever Proscenium Theatre. Performance. Well, autocratic use of theatre for propaganda is notorious. Aeschylus's command re-performance of Persians in Syracuse placed Hieron's military achievements in the West on equal footing with those of the Greeks in repelling Persia in the East. His women of Etna validated the foundation of the city of Etna in 475 at hugely destructive cost to its former inhabitants. In his Archelaus, Euripides spliced the tyrant into the royal lineage of Argos, making him a direct descendant of Heracles and turning Archelaus from tyrant to hereditary king with a firm endorsement from Zeus. But autocrats insinuated themselves into theatrical performances in other, more subtle ways, into the processions and ceremonials that precede the competitions, imprinting themselves as head of state and chief transactor of sacrifice to the gods. The unfortunate downside from their point of view was that the propaganda worked best when the tyrant's dragoons were least visible, and so such occasions offered excellent opportunity for assassination, as in the case of Philip of Macedon and Clearchus of Heraclea. Tyrants could also insinuate themselves more fully into the performances. Dionysius I of Syracuse and Mamercus of Catani both wrote tragedies. Bridget Le Guin speculates that Alexander himself may have written the satyr play again. Dionysius's tragedies included openly autobiographical content through which the autocrat depicted himself as a good tragic king. And as the theatre was the main forum in which he met his subjects face to face, image-making and careful orchestration of the tyrant's appearance in the theatre led to a theatricalization of the tyrant himself. Clearchus of Heraclea, Dionysius I, and Demetrius the Besieger are all said to have dressed like tragic kings. Dionysius even tried to confuse himself with Euripides. He's said to have acquired the instruments with which Euripides composed his tragedy and dedicated them in the sanctuary of the Muses after inscribing them with his own name and that of Euripides. Dionysius's kinsman and spin doctor, Philistus, is probably responsible for the false synchronization of Euripides' death with Dionysius's accession to power that appears in Timaeus, a suggestion, if not an actual assertion, of the reincarnation of the poet in the tyrant. Dionysius is probably also the first tyrant to fashion himself as an incarnation in some way of Dionysus, a trick, of course, that Alexander, Demetrius, the Ptolemies, and the Seleucids picked up to perfect the personalization of theatre. Well, before concluding, let's ask if autocratic states had a significant role in the spread of theatre that might rival Athens' role in disseminating it to her colonies and imperial subjects. This is obviously true in central and east Greece, where Philip, Alexander, and his successors founded and rebuilt many cities with theatres. The evidence in west Greece is more mixed. Syracuse and Aetna, founded by Hieron, probably had a theatre from its foundation in 475, and maybe so too Hellerus. Dionysius I founded Tyndarus in 396, which may have included a theatre in its original design. He also founded, supported the creation of Issa in the Adriatic, whose Roman theatre is thought, or it does in fact, overlie a Greek predecessor, and from which a 4th century comic scene, seemingly of local manufacture, was published just in 2016. But despite local promotion by tyrants, classical theatre in West Greece seems just as often to be a phenomenon of democratization. Several cities adopted drama under the democratic regimes that followed and that sprang up after the ousting of tyrants or oligarchs. Gela, for example, seems to have created a dramatic festival at the tomb of Aeschylus in a context of what Eric Robertson calls vigorous democratization following the expulsion of the tyrant. Akragas probably adopted theatre after the liberation of the tyrants in 472. Agirion, Locri, and Rhegion, cities founded or dominated by Dionysius, built theatres only after his death, when their constitutions changed from oligarchic to democratic. Well, did 5th and 4th century Greece view theatre as democratic? In many cases, perhaps most, yes. Democracy was a major factor driving Greece's theatrical revolution in the late archaic and classical epochs. Athenian colonies embraced theatre as part of their democratic heritage. The democratic cities of Athens, Aegean Empire, and hegemony also seem generally to have adopted theatre practices as close to the Athenian model as they could afford. Most tellingly, oligarchies either avoided it altogether, or if they had theatre, they avoided drama, and none, so far as we know, ever received tragedy. There are striking examples of states like Rhodes, Thebes, and the cities of Arcadia that embraced theatre as soon as they threw off the oligarchic yoke and became democracies. And examples of oligarchic cities like Chios that remained doggedly theatre-less despite their close integration into Athens' Aegean Empire. Oligarchic Megara and Sparta that already had theatre traditions remained idiosyncratic and failed to conform to the common theatre culture that was developing around them. All this shows that the spread of theatre, or its failure to spread in some areas, was due to a perception that theatre was linked in some way with democratic culture. Or at least this is true in the Greek heartland, the Peloponnese, Attica, the Aegean, and even parts of West Greece. The autocratic regimes on the fringe of the Greek world, however, clearly saw nothing irredeemably democratic in theatre culture, but on the contrary embraced it in full as an ideal instrument for maintaining and developing their power and prestige. So in answer to the question, was Greek theatre culture perceived as democratic in the late 5th and, or the 5th and 4th century, one has to say generally yes and no, or address the specifics of time, place, and purpose. The question of how broadly and how long theatre culture was perceived Athenian is much more difficult to answer. But certainly this perception is at the heart of its spread through the Athenian colonies and clerarchies. Aegean cities might have been tempted, when convenient, to regard theatre as rather more a part of a common heritage than as something strictly Athenian. But the reluctance of places like Sparta, Thebes, or Megara, traditional enemies of Athens and its empire, to adopt or adapt their theatre culture may owe something more to a perception that Athens was implicated no less than democracy. In the case of the Macedonian and Black Sea autocracies, theatre's Athenianness may in fact have proved part of the initial attraction, not least because they shared strong economic interests with Athens and its empires. Athens in turn can frequently be seen shoring up the autocrat's political and social authority, quite independently of the cultural power it exerted through theatre. Paradoxically then, the reception of theatre, and particularly drama, in the rest of Greece, even by autocracies, in many ways affirms rather than undermines the importance of both democracy and Athens in the first two centuries of its history. But at the same time, it would be a serious mistake to fall back upon the traditional assumption that therefore the only context that really matter for interpreting drama or any other form of theatre in this period are democratic and Athenian. Even if the democratic and Athenian glamour of theatre seems to stick long and hard, each time, place and purpose might allow for a strong or a weak perception of these associations. Indeed, Athenian primacy in theatre was frequently and increasingly contested. Autocrats, especially in Macedon and Sicily, increasingly challenged Athenians' economic and moral primacy in the theatre industry. Other Greek cities, particularly in the 4th century, laid claim to the invention of tragedy, comedy, satyr play, and even mime, above all Dorian and Peloponnesian cities. The challenges, particularly in the case of Syracuse and Megara, were not without foundation. Though, of course, the real issue was never just setting the historical record straight. It was to pry further at the values that contemporaries projected upon theatre, and to undermine further the common perception that the medium was, in fact, a vehicle of democratic and Athenian values. Thanks.